Hi everyone, you're listening to Heard It on a Playground, a podcast that brings important information about designing and building fun, safe and exciting playgrounds. This podcast is brought to you by the play experts at Playworks and RecTech Industries, where we share a combination of 60 plus years of experience. I'm David Wilson and I'll be your host for the podcast. Our aim is to bring you in a number of guests in the fields of parks and playgrounds. Just as the title says, Heard It on the Playground, we aim to share that expertise and help with our listeners to get tips on the best practices in the world of play. We have a great lineup of podcasts over the next few weeks, starting with our first episode, CSA, how the changing CSA standards are impacting our playgrounds. All podcasts will be recorded live, and should you want to listen again, you can get a recorded version off our website. As most listeners know, the CAN CSA Z614-14 for children's play spaces and equipment is the standard that provides the requirements for the design of public use playground equipment and play spaces intended for use by children aged 18 months to 12 years. The CSA published revisions to the standard in March of 2020, and my guests today are here to provide clarification on what these changes mean for landscape architects, designers, and planners of playgrounds. Let me introduce Jeff Kuby, design consultant from RecTech. Jeff's dad, John, started Playworks in 1986 in Edmonton, and Jeff has been working and playing in playgrounds since he was a child. Jeff started selling and designing playgrounds in Winnipeg and then moved to Vancouver to work with RecTech about 5 years ago. I'd also like to introduce Greg Howden, operations manager at RecTech. Greg tracks everything related to the ebb and flow of playgrounds. As the resident expert of the CSA standards for over 10 years, Greg keeps his fingers on the pulse of any changes that occur within the industry.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
That's great. I hear you loud and clear this morning. How's the weather in Vancouver?
The weather today is cloudy and overcast and probably a little drizzly.
No different from normal then, eh?
Right.
Well, anyway, Greg, can I start with you if that's okay? Why don't you tell me or tell the audience and myself what kind of changes occurred with the user age groups?
Yeah, thanks, David. Welcome, everybody. The user age groups actually haven't changed the specific ages that the CSA guideline covers, but what they've done now in the new 2020 guideline is they've just reinforced the idea or the notion that the user age groups really are guidelines only. And they're not to be taken literally. The 2 to 5 and the 5 to 12 cutoffs, some of the younger children are going to fall more into the older age group and vice versa, depending on their ability. So it's just a reminder to designers and owners that the age groups really are just guidelines only. And in cases of, good supervision or kids who are maybe, developing faster than other kids, they can move between those two age groups depending on the circumstances.
So in practical terms, Jeff, how does that kind of affect you, you know, when you're actually designing a playground?
Well, yeah, it comes up quite a lot actually. And I think one of the limitations potentially that when somebody sees a piece that says 2 to 5 on it, but really it has application for 5 to 12 year olds as well, it's hard for our customers and our designers to bridge that gap and say, well, is this really appropriate for 5 to 12 year olds if it's been designated for a 2 to 5 use? And a really good example of that is one of our very popular pieces. We have these multi-seesaws. They fit up to 9 kids, has really high action for 5 to 12 year olds, but the intended use and the initial use was actually for 2 to 5 year olds. And so the product has been designated as such because the CSA requires it have a designation, but really it has great application for 5 to 12 year olds. And it's just nice that the CSA acknowledges that there is really more of a flexible user range depending on the piece. And some pieces really do bridge that gap.
It's a much more pragmatic approach, I would think, eh?
Yeah, I think that realistically, as Greg had mentioned, kids develop at different speeds and also that each piece of equipment has potentially different uses and different ways of using it depending on the age of that child and the age of the user as they go through the developmental process.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to move on to another point which I picked up on is the sort of looping standard that's just come up as well. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, David, looping has always been a bit of a challenge when it comes to manipulatives. So something like a musical instrument that needs a mallet in order to be hit, it's always been a challenge because there are looping restrictions and concerns about the cord or the rope that connects the mallet to the piece. So the new CSA guideline just provides some guidance on how those cables can be attached in a safe way. And there is now a formal exemption to the looping, anti-looping requirement for things like mallets or maybe even like a cup that is needed for a sand element, something like that. There are guidelines on how those manipulatives can be safely attached and meet the looping requirement.
So one of the other points I noticed as well, I understand there's an increased interest in sort of natural playgrounds, and the CSA has renamed the clause natural materials from wood. Can you clarify the standard and what it means for playground designers? Jeff, could you dive into that one?
So natural materials have been, for the most part, not covered by the standard in terms of the way that they review the materials. Often materials need to be tested for longevity purposes. They need to be structurally tested. So natural materials such as stones and rocks and logs, while they're great in nature, and it's intuitive that, you know, we go out to the forest and we encourage our kids to play in the forest and to play on natural rocks and logs in a play environment when there's liability at stake and we're designing things intentionally to give children safe risk, if there's potentiality for logs and rocks to, you know, potentially deteriorate over time and create a hazard for children that they don't see themselves, that's been difficult for the CSA to look at in the past. And so the CSA is starting to include those types of materials and allow them within the play space. But as Greg is, I'm sure, going to fill in here, there is got to be testing and a review process for those materials to ensure that it's not just an open process where you can use anything you'd like. It really needs to be reviewed and made sure that there's testing of some kind to make sure that those materials, when selected, are appropriate for the space.
Yeah, and just to fill in a few details there, there really are two requirements. So now that natural materials such as logs and rocks are specifically allowed in the new CSA guideline, there are two requirements that are called out. So one is, and I'll quote here, the item needs to be purposely and individually selected for their intended function, and they need to comply with Chapter 9, which is structural integrity. So this really just means that if you're going to pick a log, it needs to be specifically intended for its purpose. So and you need to take into consideration, you know, basic safety things like sharp edges, you know, big cracks maybe in a log that might encourage insects to nest, things like that. So as long as you're looking out for hazards like that and you're specifically selecting something for a playground, logs and rocks are now officially permitted under this new CSA guideline.
Okay, got you. And I like this pragmatic approach. It's really just sort of working in real time, isn't it, in real world environments, which is really, really good, really reassuring. How does the new CSA requirements impact surfacing and also elevated surfaces?
Yeah, elevated surfaces, and just a reminder for everyone listening that a fall height from a given piece of equipment is determined from the highest elevated surface. And the formal term for that is a designated play surface. And so until now, the CSA guideline, they offered a definition of what a designated play surface is, but they didn't really offer any protocol or any testing device even that someone could use to test for that. So what the new CSA guideline does is it just provides that testing protocol, and it describes a specific testing device that a designer or an owner can use to go to a playground and test for a designated play surface to determine the proper fall height of a piece of equipment.
And Jeff, from a practical viewpoint, how does that affect you as a designer?
Well, you know, when we talk about natural rocks and logs, in Vancouver, we have a really great community of landscape architects and designers and rec managers that we really like the idea of using natural pieces of equipment and natural materials. And so sometimes our customers and our designers will select pieces to be used in a play space, but there will be no formal testing to see how that designated play surface is tested for. So a rock will be selected, but it won't necessarily have a designated fall height rating. And so this really just allows users to be able to, and owners to be able to test their own play spaces to ensure that surfacing materials are compliant, that it's your five bar is deep enough, for instance, your poured in place rubber is at the right depth. And so that in general, the testing can be a little bit more thorough for these more flexible spaces.
So just moving on to a separate topic now, has there been any changes to equipment requirements?
Yeah, so this is an interesting change. So chapter 15 in the CSA is the long chapter that breaks out the specific design requirements and performance requirements for equipment. So it talks about maybe 15 to 20 of the basic pieces of playground equipment that we all know, like slides and swings and things like that. But because the playground industry is always coming out with such, you know, innovative new products, it is difficult to slot those into those into that chapter. So what chapter 15 does now is it has a clause at the beginning, 15.1, that provides instructions for assessing a new piece of equipment and determining whether it does comply with the CSA or not. So what they're calling for is a hazard process called a hazard identification and risk assessment. And it's an assessment that needs to be done and documented to determine whether a new piece of equipment that maybe doesn't fall into a traditional description can meet and comply with the CSA guidelines.
And just to really drill down on that risk assessment, what does that practically mean? What type of things would you envisage a proper risk assessment would include?
So what the CSA has done is they've left that pretty open to a designer or an owner. They haven't called out a specific protocol for that, but what they have done is they've introduced a new annex in the back of the book, Annex J, and they provided an example. So it's a chart that that gives some specific examples of the steps that you can go through. So checking, so for example, if the piece in question spins, well, what is a hazard, a typical hazard of a spinning piece, and what do you need to look out for? If your piece is a climbing net, for example, what kind of things do you look out for? So they have provided an example, but they haven't specified a requirement. So they've left it open to the judgment of the owner or designer.
And if that is that something that RecTech or Playworks could help a customer with in terms of doing a risk assessment in those situations?
Yeah, absolutely. What we would likely do is direct the person to that annex. If it's endorsed by the CSA, that would be a great starting point. But yeah, Jeff and I and the team here at RecTech definitely provide any kind of guidance or feedback that we can.
Perfect. So I understand playground designers have more space for designs because of the change to rotating equipment and encroachment zones. Can one of you explain that in more detail?
Actually, I was going to add something to the last point, and it has to do with rotating equipment. Okay. So there's a really great example, a very popular piece that I know that in Alberta, Manitoba has been sold, BC a number of times. A lot of our landscape architects here really enjoy the Kaiser & Kuhn Dutch disc, which is one of those pieces that would certainly fall into the Annex J type of category where it's a new style of spinner that really is unique in the industry. It sort of stands alone in the way that it operates. And in the past, it really has had no evaluation because it doesn't really fall within the evaluation guidelines of the CSA. It's obviously safe. We haven't had any kids that have really hurt themselves on it. And we've had some customers sign off and say, we know that this isn't quite addressed. And it's just nice that the CSA is addressing these pieces within the standard and allowing customers to buy innovative play products that aren't necessarily addressed yet, but can do a self-evaluation to ensure that there is an evaluation on pieces like that. And it isn't just an open deny or accept on pieces that are either covered or not by the standard. And as that pertains to the next rule, as you're talking about, David, there is changes to the spinning rules in the CSA as well. And this is a pretty interesting one. Looking back from even before 2014, I remember getting trained in the CSA, and there used to be a different rule even than now. And so what we used to have for multi-user spinning pieces or spinners that are greater than 1 meter in diameter is that the piece would have its natural 6 foot fall zone, but then there would be an additional 6 feet of non-encroachment zone area that can't overlap with the fall zones, that you can put pathways there, et cetera. But really the intention of that additional zone was to allow for kids to, and adults and any user that's approaching the piece or trying to get around the piece, to get around that high action item without being in the fall trajectory of a high action spinning piece. So that was the rule before 2014. When it moved to after 2014, they only made that a 3 foot zone rather than six, but they called it an additional fall zone. And that additional fall zone could overlap with other fall zones, which wasn't the case before, but now it couldn't overlap with other non-encroachment zones. So it created new design challenges. And so the CSA has really, I think, done something quite smart and quite useful for designers in that allowing that additional 3 foot zone to again, like before 2014, to overlap with other non-encroachment zones. So for instance, a swing, which in the two-fro trajectory, you have a non-encroachment zone on either side of that swing, and a spinner now with its additional 3 foot zone for the large multi-user and large diameter spinners, that additional 3 feet can overlap with the non-encroachment zone, which is a huge space saver and something which makes non-encroachment zones and fall zones challenging to work with. And swings and multi-spinners in particular tend to take a lot of space. This is really going to bring down the budgets of playgrounds because they don't need to be as big. It also will make it so they don't look so cavernous because these large zones that you can't overlap with. So it really has a lot of great application. Sorry, I sort of stole your thunder there, Greg, but I wanted to riff on that.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those explanations that's a little difficult to appreciate verbally. So there are some great illustrations in the new CSA guideline that make this clear in the back of the book. And Jeff and I would be happy to share them with you by email if you'd like to get a copy of them, if you don't have a copy of the CSA book. But it will be clearer when you see the example in the book.
Well, that's phenomenal. And that was a nice segue, by the way, Jeff. I thought that was pretty good linking those two subjects together. One final thing, I think it's important to follow up with something that you feel is quite important. What would you say is, you know, something you'd like to key in before we finish?
Yeah, well, for me, there's a couple. I just want to touch on surfacing. One of the really nice changes in this new guideline is the surfacing requirements for low-level pieces. So this new change states that any static piece that sits lower than 450 mils or 18 inches no longer requires specific safety surfacing. We can now use natural ground material such as grass and earth instead of, say, a wood fiber or a rubber surface. So this is a really nice change for those low risk, low level, static playgrounds. It's really going to help a certain category of customer where maybe budget is a concern or things like that. So I know, Jeff, for your designs, this is going to be great for you and your customers. Any comments to share on that one?
Yeah, I think this really opens up. This really opens up playground design for budgets that are a lot smaller. One of the things that I always find with customers is, particularly new playground buyers, is that they really focus in on the equipment costs and you know, their budget, they assume, goes mainly to equipment. And the reality is that a lot of that budget ends up getting eaten by site development costs, by the surfacing. So the requirement for having fall protective surfacing underneath low-level equipment used to be quite a barrier, particularly for clients like daycares, for even small community parks where there would be low-level parkour or, you know, something that's like a balance log. These would be really low-level risks in terms of the reality of falling off a, you know, one-foot balance beam. It's no different than necessarily falling off a small set of stairs or something like that. you know, for kids, it would be a small risk to fall off a balance beam. And so having the ability for soft surfaces such as grass and soil, as you've mentioned, to have that underneath the playground really saves costs, because now you're not paying for port in place rubber, you're not paying for 5R, you're not paying for the excavation costs and for all the site development costs that would normally be associated. And you really are just buying the equipment. So if you wanted to buy a playhouse, you could just buy the playhouse and the installation of that playhouse rather than having to invest in some fairly expensive surfacing. And I just want to stress that it doesn't allow for things like concrete, and it also doesn't allow for you to still put, say, a concrete edge that's only 3 feet away from that balance beam. You really have to still consider the pieces as still having a fall zone, but the surfacing itself is now flexible. So you can make it a soft surface such as soil or grass, synthetic turf, that kind of thing. I do see a lot of hope and desire from the design community here in Vancouver to use a natural rock, for instance, or log, and then have a seating wall that's only 3 feet away. So that certainly doesn't get around the fact that that would be a hazard to fall off that piece and, you know, crack your head on a seating wall. It's still not allowed. But the surfacing underneath those play items can be a lot less cumbersome and expensive to get around.
So really giving great flexibility, that's the important thing. Well, we've literally got about another minute to go. So guys, what would be the last thing you would want to say about the new CSA? Is there anything else that we haven't covered that you think is important for our guests to hear?
Yeah, one last item I'd like to bring up, David, before we go, is just the addition of another annex at the back of the book that's called Thermal Comfort. And this really touches on a key to a successful playground. Is it's one thing to get the kids to the playground, but how do you actually keep the kids at the playground? And one of the ways is through play value, making sure that the playground equipment has a challenging play value to it. But another thing is to make sure that the kids are comfortable. And so this annex talks about things like designing for shade, designing for wind prevention, proper material selection so that plastics and metals don't get too hot, access to bathrooms and water fountains, things like that. So this is a really nice, non-mandatory, I just want to stress that point, a really nice chapter for designers and owners to read, just to really reinforce the idea that that keeping kids comfortable is just as important as creating challenging and fun playgrounds.
I want to thank all our guests today for sharing their knowledge and expertise. And if you have any further questions, you can reach them at rectechindustries.com and playworks.ca. And I want to thank all our listeners for taking the time out of the day to join us. If you like what you hear, please send us a message. And of course, share our website with others. That's playworks.ca and rectechindustries.com. Check us out on social media if you'd like to learn more about what we do. We're on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and of course, Instagram. Our next podcast is next Wednesday, May 6th, as Bart Zelenak from Playworks outlines the most important things for making your next school playground popular with the students. We'll see you there. Goodbye, and happy playing.